Hi there, I'm Carlin Abbey, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very much for joining me. I just finished Skype talking with Ho Fung Hung about his new book, The China Boom: Why China Will Not Rule the World. This came out with Columbia University Press in 2016. Now, the book takes on and explores a number of intersecting and interweaving threads and concepts and ideas that are really timely, really important, and really, really engaging as we understand not just China's economy right now and how to situate the contemporary economy of China within the recent historical past, but also how to understand the significance and role of China and the Chinese economy within a larger global frame. So as you'll hear me talking about at the beginning of the interview, the book has two major goals. The first goal is to look at the origins, and you'll again hear this in a little bit, of the capitalist boom in China, right? This takes us back to the title of the book, and the political formations and the social formations in the 80s that really gave rise to this boom. So the book does several things in pursuing this particular goal. It considers why capitalism did not spontaneously emerge in 18th century China. It looks at how and why 19th and early 20th century state builders failed to foster state-directed capitalism, as they had done in Japan, and you'll hear us talking about that as well. It considers how the Mao period, and specifically the rural, agrarian, and urban industrial developments in that period, laid the foundation for the capitalist boom of the 80s. And it also, in the words of the book, discusses the regional, global, and socio-political contexts at the turn of the 21st century that have made such a boom possible. Ho Fung maintains here, and this is from the very beginning of the book, that there's no such thing as Chinese capitalism. That's fundamentally different from other kinds of capitalism. Instead, the book explores how capitalism adapts to, thrives in, and falters under Chinese conditions. Now, the second goal of the book is to explore, and again, you'll hear us talking about this, the global impacts and the global effects of this boom in China, and also the limits of that boom. And in doing that, it critically assesses four common conceptions of how China is reshaping the world. I'll take you through these four, and then I will leave you to the interview. Number one, it critically assesses the common conception that China is, in the words of the book, challenging the free market ideology and global free market or neoliberal order that the U.S. has been promoting since the 1980s. Common conception number two, the common perception that China is both reversing a long-term trend of income polarization between the West and the rest, right, the West and the rest of the world, and that it's providing a new model and new opportunities for developing countries. You'll hear us talking about this second conception and how it's a lot more complicated than that. Three, the conception that China is challenging the existing world order by challenging or replacing the dominance of the West in general and the U.S. specifically, and you'll hear us talking about that. And four, the conception that China is, in the words of the book, rescuing the global economy by becoming the most powerful driver of growth. And you'll also hear us talking about that as well. As Ho Fung puts it here in the book, the boom is destined to collapse. And we'll talk about the implications of that in the hour to come. So I'll leave you to it and just say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the support of the channel that listening is. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here today to talk with Ho Fung Hung about his new book, The China Boom. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Ho Fung, and thanks very much both for writing a really provocative book that's very much a pleasure to read, and also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Carla. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the question that is traditional for the channel, and here's how we'll get there. In the preface of the book, you talk about your family background that brought you to the study of China and to an engagement with issues surrounding and involving China. So let's talk a little bit about how you came not only to work on China, but how you came to the field as an academic space. So Ho Fung, could you start by saying what brought you to the study of China and the sociology of China specifically?
Yeah, this is quite interesting that when I went to college in Hong Kong, in the Chinese University of Hong Kong in the early 1990s, I wasn't a majoring in sociology or any social science and humanities discipline. I majored in electronic engineering. But at that time, it was quite a turbulent time in Hong Kong that the 1989 student movement has just ended a lot long ago, and Hong Kong has been kind of facing the 1997 sovereignty handover. And I got involved in the student organizations in the universities, and there's a sense of among the young people that there's a sense that we are the generation that is going to be doing things that change things about Hong Kong, about China. And many of them, actually, I have a lot of friends that who start in like the business school and medical school, they all shift to different social science discipline because of this kind of conviction. So I'm one of them, and moved to sociology to study a lot for the sake of studying China and Asia, but also for the sake of changing it. So it is why I moved to sociology in the first place. And I read a lot of books, definitely, but at the same time, in the early 1990s, that Emmanuel Wallerstein visited Hong Kong, and then Peter Scotchpole visited Hong Kong and talk about all this fancy theory about world system analysis, global capitalism, and state and social revolution, and so on and so forth. So it is my intellectual background to move to sociology and to study of China.
Including fancy theory.
Yeah, including fancy theories, yes.
Shout out to fancy theory. That's always an important part.
Yes.
So early in the book, you lay out two main research projects that have defined your intellectual agenda, as you describe it here.
Yeah.
The first one is, and this is in the words of the book, an attempt to delineate the origins and particularities of political modernity in China by way of protests from early modern to contemporary times.
Yes.
And the second major research project is an attempt to, in the words of the book, trace the origins, unveil the core dynamics, and assess the global repercussions of China's economic resurgence in the world. Now, the book that we're talking about today falls under the umbrella of this last project that I just mentioned. So let's talk about that. How, Hofeng, did you come to a focus on this particular project, and what brought you to really the focus that makes up the core of this book? Let's talk a little bit about the genesis of the project for you.
Yes, definitely. That actually, the two books have some internal connection to one another. And I didn't mention it explicitly in the preface, but I realized that it's so important I should have mentioned it. That is the both of my project, Protests with Chinese Characteristics and Protests, Petition Riots and Protests in Ming-Qing Dynasty, and this one, the China Boom, they are both implicitly or explicitly a response to the California School in historiography, China historiography. That because when I was pursuing a PhD in sociology in the world system tradition in the late 1990s, it was the beginning, and actually it is not yet the heyday, but it's the beginning of the California School, that Kenneth Pomerance is about to publish The Great Divergence, and Bin Wong's China Transform already published. And as you know, that the California School is a kind of a term created by a sociologist. That is one of my favorite sociologists, Jack Goldstone, when he was in UC Davis, and he grouped this historian, China historian, that argued that the divergence, economic divergence between China and Europe was not as deep-rooted as many sociologists and historians used to think, like Philip Huang, Max Weber, and all this. Because in the old historiography, that industrial revolution happened in Europe, but not in China, and China became poor after the 19th century. It had deep cultural, institutional root, like some people would trace it back to medieval period, and some people trace it back all the way to the Roman Empire and Han Dynasty and all this kind of cultural institutional difference. And the California School, including Ken Pomerance and Bin Wong, and of course Andrew Gunnar Frank, who wrote the book The Reorient, basically a synthesis of all this California School to address the contemporary issue, that their argument is that this divergence between China and Europe was a lot deep, and it was quite contingent and accidental even then. And China economically was at least as advanced as Europe up until the late 18th century, or even more advanced than Europe. And it was just a kind of a contingent shift because of all kind of crisis and situation that allowed Europe to go ahead, and China became subjugated and poor in the next 100 and 150 years. So this is a historiography. It is very inspiring at the time, that is the late 1990s. And many sociologists and social scientists like Andrew Gunder Frank used it to address the contemporary issue of China's rise. And actually, it is no longer restricted to California school. And you can see this kind of conception in many popular writing and academic writing, even not China scholars. Like you read Farid Zakaria, Post-American World, you read Joseph Lai, The Soft Power. They all have the notion that actually China rise right now in the last 20, 30 years is actually not so surprising, because it's just China coming back to its historical place at the center of the world. That was that was the situation, and that was the status quo up to the late 18th century. So it is just the time between 1800 to 1950 is just a kind of a brief deviation from this historical normal. So it is this kind of California school and a conception about China in history and in contemporary world that inspired me to do these two projects. And of course, I have both agreement and disagreement with this group of scholarship. The disagreement part is that you cannot only look at economics first. So it is why I do my first book. I look at the trajectory of state formation, political ideology, and the pattern of protest, to look at how actually China diverged deeply from Europe, not economically, but politically. And it is this political divergence defined by the Confucianist state and the popular protest conception of justice, which is very, very different from Enlightenment Europe conception of popular sovereignty and all that, that determined divergence later on in the 19th and 20th centuries. And my historical analysis of Chinese protests has also extended into the contemporary period to look at how this traditional conception of justice and traditional expectation of the state continue to influence the repertoire of protests in 20th century and contemporary China. So it is my first book, and dealing with my first disagreement and a critical dialogue with the California school. And my second book now, that is the China Boom, is to look at the dynamics behind the contemporary China rise. So in disagreement with the California school, I don't see the contemporary rise of China is going back to China's historical place in the early modern times or earlier. This is a different dynamics. China is not becoming a new center of the world, because there's a lot of talk recently, in the recent years, about China's going to rule the world. And there's actually a very best-selling book or that with that particular title, that is When China Ruled the World, and China is replacing the U.S. as the world hegemon. So there's a lot of this kind of expectation, not among historians, but among the social scientists who are inspired by the California school. So my this book, China Boom, is to debunk this myth and telling the story that actually the China's contemporary rise is very much this dependent on the U.S. hegemony, and it has a lot of internal contradiction. It is going to meet a lot of challenges that it is not easy to tackle. In the end, China might become a normal capitalist powers like Japan and Germany together with U.S., but definitely is not becoming a kind of alternative economic model or a new center of the world.
Great. Thank you. I should just kind of turn it over to you. just be like, hey, talk about your book. I'm just going to be here for a few minutes because you have a lot to say. This is great. Okay, so as we move into the introduction to the book, you lay out two goals, and there's a lot more happening there, but we'll kind of move into the chapters and readers can figure out. So the first goal of the book, as you say in the introduction and in the words of the introduction, is to outline the historical origins of China's capitalist boom and the social and political formations in the 80s, the 1980s, that gave rise to this boom. And so listeners will hear the mention of origins. And there's, I think in both of your projects, as you've described them, there's a really interesting concern with origins and with tracing that permeates both projects.
The
second goal of the book is to explore, again, in the words of the book, the global effects of China's capitalist boom and the limit of that boom. And we'll talk about this. Like, by the end of our conversation and by the end of the book, we're going to, you're going to argue, right, that the boom is destined to collapse. And so we'll get to that, I hope, by the end of our conversation. But first, let's get into the first part of the book. So the first part of the book traces the rise of capitalism in China from the 18th century to now, as a way of getting at, again, the origins of the contemporary, the current capitalist boom. So chapter one takes us into the 17th and 18th centuries, and it looks at how a massive influx and inpouring of American silver into China in this period fueled a commercial revolution that, in the words of the book, made China the most advanced market economy in the early modern world. And I think, Hofeng, are you brushing something against your microphone?
Yes, maybe.
Great.
Maybe.
So whatever you're doing now is awesome. Okay. So this made China the most advanced market economy in the early modern world, in the words of the book. It also looks at the aspects of politics and society in this period that limited China's growth, at least relative to the expansion of industrial capitalism in Europe. And here, the book really engages very explicitly with this California school that you mentioned. Okay. So I'm going to hit a question back to you to sort of open up what you think is most important about what's happening here. Now, you say here in this book, in this part of the book, that Europe saw, again, in the words of the book, the popularization of a unique engineering culture and the development of a strong entrepreneurial elite. And this became really important to what was happening. Why was this not the case in China, and why is this so important?
Yes, because first of all, I am adopting a kind of a Braudelian conception of capitalism. And in the social science and humanities, there's a lot of confusion. And many people treat capitalism and market as the same thing. As I outline in the book, from a Braudelian long theory perspective, market and capitalism are actually different things. And market is kind of exchange of goods among small producers, people. And the end of it is to have everybody has what they want. But capitalism is based on a very different imperative, that is the accumulation of capital for the sake of accumulating more capital. So this kind of accumulation process, you need to have concentration of resources into a few hands. We need definitely capitalists. Actually, the people who actually do the accumulating of wealth and profits and reinvestment and expand the scale of operation, so on and so forth. So the market and capitalism operate on very different logic. And while we see what we see in China in the 17th, 18th century is a very prosperous and very advanced market, but without capitalists, because without capitalists, you cannot concentrate the surplus and resources gathered in the peasant household, which is a very important unit of production and economic activities in China at that time, as in Europe, at the contemporary and the contemporaneous period. But without a capitalist class that can accumulate wealth not only over individual capitalist lifetime, but in over generations of capitalist families, and you don't have the kind of resources available to anybody that can do the engineering and inventions and all these kind of not only invention of technology, but also invention of business organization, organizational production, necessary for industrial takeoff. That is what is the big difference between China and Europe at the early modern period. Europe also has a developing and advancing market economy, but what is different in Europe that China didn't have is a very entrenched capitalist class that they are protected by the state, and they not only capitalists all not only prosperous in their lifetime, but they have a generation and generation of capitalists. You look at many of these kind of examples, like the Rothschild family and all these early industrializers in Britain. They are not really self-made men. Then they have been coming from the merchant families, a banker family, and then in their generation in the early 19th century, they just shift to industry. So there is a kind of accumulation of wealth going on for generation that China lacked that, not in the absolute sense, because we also see a lot of merchant groups like the Anhui merchants, very well known, and the Shanxi bankers and so on and so forth. But the China pattern is that these capitalists, after they accumulate enough fortunes, they won't prefer to let the future generation, the later generation, to continue the business, and they rather invest the wealth they accumulate into building schools and getting the kids educated, and so they can take the examination and become shifting to a bureaucratic career. So many of these, for example, the Anhui merchants that was very prosperous in Suzhou, in the end, they shift to become a bureaucratic families, and nobody, not many people remember their merchant origin. So it is this kind of intergenerational accumulation strategy is very different. And you to explain this different, you cannot focus only on the economics. You have to focus on the politics of the state, how the state and the society is related. So it is my take on the early modern China, that there's a very prosperous market with the surplus and resources scattered and decentralized, but China simply lack a kind of an entrenched capitalist class like Europe to concentrate and accumulate this surplus and then create a large business organization that in the end engineer industrial takeoff.
That's right. And as the chapter further emphasizes, just to kind of put a point on what you're saying, 18th yeah. century China was in fact governed by what you call a centralized paternalist state. It was yeah. afraid of the kind of unrest that was coming from rising inequality in that period. And
yes.
this actually takes us really nicely into the second chapter. So yeah. after looking at the 17th and 18th century, chapter two mm-hmm. takes us into the 19th and 20th. And it yeah. follows generations of state builders in China
yeah.
as they try to foster state-directed industrialization mm-hmm. in the footsteps of, as you describe here, Germany and Japan mm-hmm. and Russia. And you've already talked a little bit about that. And
yeah.
as a response to what you kind of describe here as the rise of Western imperialism from the mid-19th mm-hmm. century on. Now, the chapter yeah. asks, among other things, what did the Qing state attempt to do and why did that fail? And we've already talked a little bit about this, but another project mm-hmm. that comes up here that I'll just mark and then we'll kind of move on mm-hmm. is that you mention that the Qing kind of sponsored an industrialization program that was mm-hmm. meant to move surplus from the countryside to foster industrial capital, right? But
yeah.
there was too much unrest for
yes.
work. And so this sort of yeah. focus on unrest also, I think, harkens back to what you were describing earlier
yes.
in terms of your interests more broadly in protest and
yes.
and how that's shaping the story. Did you want to say just a little bit about the importance of unrest here before we move to 1949?
Yes, there's two dimensions of unrest that in that chapter I briefly compared Japan with China, because actually after the mid 19th century, Japan and China faced the same kind of challenge. That is, they have a prosperous developed market economy with all these surplus and resources decentralized among peasant household. So how you jumpstart an industrial revolution to meet the challenge of Western imperialism by concentrating these resources through the state-directed industrialization program. So the Meiji Restoration and the self in Japan and the self-strengthening movement in China in the late 19th century is very similar, but in the end, Japan succeeded and China failed. One reason is that in the mid 19th century in China, and after that, even after the successful repression of the Taiping Rebellion, there's still a lot of the local secret society and heterodox religious groups, and peasant rebellions is continue to border the Qing state, and then they also they have something to do with the ethnic composition of the Qing state, as pointed out by the Liu Qing history people, that the Qing state by nature is a Manchu state, is a kind of ethnic minority. And in the 18th century, they didn't trust the Han elite. So the imperial army was basically fully staffed by the Manchus and the Mongols. But in the 19th century, when the unrest became so much a trouble to the state, so they start to let the local Han elite to arm themselves, as Philip Kuhn's classic study showed, that local militarization. In that situation, that the late 19th century Qing state is actually politically undergoing a decentralization, that the central government is losing their monopoly of violence, and then local elites are building up their own private armies and militias and all that. And it definitely eat up a lot of resources that could have been otherwise diverted to economic development. And of course, and another factor is that the Western imperialism is always continue to be a big headache to China, even after the Opium War and after the Taiping Rebellion. So there's all this kind of external and internal pressure that make China's centralized government crumble with this local rise of militarized local elite. While in Japan, while everybody, European powers are busy in China, so Japan was relatively not bothered that much by Western imperialism. Only the Americans opening up free trade with them, and the European powers has little interest compared to China to cough up Japan. And at the same time, the Meiji state really highly centralized state has a thrust to cracking down on the local daimyo, local warlord. And so it has a much stronger centralized institution to effectively concentrate the resource from the peasant to direct state-led industrialization program. So it is the divergence between Japan and China in the end. Japan succeed in this late industrialization state-directed, but China, it's not a total failure. It still succeed, but it's not as successful in Japan. And when the Qing Navy was defeated by Japan in the Sino-Japanese War in the 1890s, that this divergence would get larger and larger. And then in the end, the Qing Empire collapsed, and China went through another half century of chaos and war and the failed state building and state centralization. So it is the divergence.
Great. So after taking us through this, we move to 1949. And I won't ask you to talk too much about this, but I just want to mark this moment for listeners. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese Communist Party came to power in 49, and the CCP undertook a model that was based on a Soviet model, where they collectivized the rural economy and redirected the surpluses from there to feed urban industrialization. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have been successful, right? By the late 70s, as you describe here, as a result, there was a network in China of state-owned industrial capital and infrastructure. Now, this becomes important because what we're going to see as we now move forward into the next chapter is there were important foundations in this way that were laid in the Mao period for what came after and for this boom that we're talking about. And this is one of the really important points, I think, that you emphasize here, is that this boom was not a break with the Maoist past. In fact, there are important antecedents or foundations that we have to acknowledge and talk about. So let's talk a little bit about that. So chapter three situates the contemporary rise of capitalism in China on two foundations. One of them is the foundation that was laid in the Mao period. And we just talked a little bit about that. You talk here about the importance of having a large, educated, rural surplus labor force and this network of state-owned capital. And we just talked a little bit about that. You also talk here about the importance of Cold War East Asian capitalism by Asian allies of the U.S. These are areas that are often referred to as the East Asian Tigers. You call them East Asian Tigers here, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore.
Yes.
And then from here, and we're moving at a rapid clip here because there's a lot of book to get to, right? You move from here to talking about what happens after Mao. And here we come to two phases of post-Mao market reform. We have the 1980s, where there was a focus on the revival of market economy and rural growth. And then the 1990s, where there's a focus on the transformation of state-owned enterprises into profit-oriented capitalist corporations. And here's a moment where I want to kind of redirect it a little bit. Mm-hmm. You talk about the example of China Mobile, As an example of one of these latter 1990s transformations of SEOs or state-owned enterprises into profit-oriented capitalist corporations. Can you talk a little bit about that? What do you think is most important for us to understand about this phenomenon and perhaps about this example in order for us to understand what you want us to kind of take away most from this part of the book?
Yes, China Mobile is an interesting case because it showed a continuity between the Mao and the post-Mao period. The China Mobile was floated in the Hong Kong and the New York Stock Exchange as a kind of a champion state-owned enterprises, profit-oriented enterprises, and still today is a very successful enterprise in terms of its revenue and very big, very influential. But it was created by a collaboration between Wall Street financial firms and the China state assets and state facilities that was constructed with the legacies of the Mao era, because China Mobile, before it was a company, it was a company actually created from thin air. So all the telecommunications infrastructures and facilities were operated by different levels of government in China. So at some point, the Wall Street financial firm went to China's government and floated an idea. What about you concentrate all these assets operated by all local governments and central governments, put all these assets into account book of one newly created state company, and then we help you float this company in foreign stock exchange. And then they struck a deal. I mean, the financial firms in Wall Street and the Chinese government at that time, and then created China Mobile and put all these telecommunication facilities previously operated and taken care of by local government into that company. And then that company instantly become a company packed with valuable telecommunication assets and monopoly of the market. And it was folded in 1997 in the foreign stock exchange market, and it was a success and still is a very big enterprise. So it is a very capitalist enterprise in the sense that its goal is to, a lot like the state-owned enterprises in the socialist period, to provide full employment, to provide welfare benefit to the workers and education, so on and so forth. So they don't have all these kind of social functions. They are purely a capitalist enterprise in the sense that its whole goal is to serve the interests of the shareholders and to make profits. And then it was created out from the telecommunication networks and facilities that the Chinese government built since the Mao period, and a collaboration with the Wall Street financial firm. So it is kind of a very exemplary case showing how these national champion state enterprises are about. And because I know that many commentators and critical of neoliberal free market economy and things that the China model is superior and very, very different because of this continuous significance of state-owned enterprise that has a socialist legacy in it and so on and so forth, even can represent a kind of alternative, better, more humane model of economic growth. But the case of China Mobile and many now the champion state-owned enterprise show that they are owned, the majority stake still owned by the state. So it is the only difference between this kind of enterprise and the private enterprise in anywhere else in the world. But in terms of the logic of operation, in terms of all these financial trick that make it happen, they are very much 100% capitalist enterprises. So they are not superior or very radically different from other big transnational corporation in the world.
That's right. And here, and you make this point toward the end of this chapter, and this is the first that I'll mention or that I'll mark of what we're going to do now for each one of the chapters moving forward, which is to kind of point to what I like to think of as a nuh-uh moment, or sort of a moment where you're like, everyone thinks this, but actually that is true. Or what we can maybe think of as the China boom goes boom moment, because we're going to explode an assumption. So here, as you just mentioned, the chapter is really emphasizing the fact that, as you just described in the case of this example, the China boom is actually dependent on global free trade and the flow of investment, and China does not kind of constitute or emblematize an alternative to the dominant global neoliberal order. So I mention that because each one of the chapters really does that as we move forward. It takes something that we, or that some people have argued, have assumed, have asserted, and shows that it's actually not the case. So we move to part two of the book as we move into these chapters. This is a part of the book that looks closely at the impact of the China boom on the global political economic order and on the demise of this boom. So chapter four looks very closely at how China's capitalist boom has reshaped global inequality. This is a really fascinating chapter, I think. So inequality has been growing rapidly in China, as you say this. At the same time, even the poorest segment of the population has seen growth at a higher rate than the worldwide average of growth. So for listeners who may not understand, sort of, what's the big deal? Why is that important? Can you talk about this? Why is this important, and what implications does this have for kind of the main point or points that you're making in this part of the book?
Yes, because the people, like not only scholars, but also practitioners and policymakers in the United Nations and all these international organizations, even the IMF, World Bank, and WTO, they have been concerned about rising global inequality, that is, inequality of income between countries. And there has been a huge debate going on in among economists, political scientists, and sociology, this, whether this globalization and world trade that we are undergoing is aggravating world inequality or reducing it. And of course, the world inequality has been constantly on the rise since the Western Industrial Revolution and the history of imperialism, and it didn't stop with decolonization and the end of colonialism. So China's rise provide us an interesting case because you include China in the calculation of world average income among countries, that really China is a big driver in world income inequality reduction, and also a big driver in world poverty reduction. According to many different measures, the world inequality has been reducing, and then world poverty has been reducing. And most of these achievements are actually attributable to the economic improvement in China, even among the poorest segments of China's population. That there's a big widening inequality among the pace of improvement between, like, for example, people in Shanghai and also people in Guizhou and in the rural area. But even the poorest people in Guizhou has been seeing this alleviation of poverty and improvement in income higher than many other developing countries. So China become an interesting case, as many people point out, that it first, it is the big driver of this improvement in poverty and inequality. At the same time, that I'm asking the question and I'm exploring whether the China experience of poverty reduction and inequality reduction can be extended to other developing countries. So in that part, I am telling a more complicated stories that because China's in the last 30 years has contributed a lot to this poverty inequality reduction, but it's not going to continue, because when China approached the middle income category, so first it is more difficult to pull the income further up, at least not with the speed that it used to do it. At the same time, after China's average income surpassed the world average, the more China grow, income grow, then the more unequal the world will become, because then China become the middle class or even upper middle class. And when they move up, that the gap between China and the poorer countries will be widening. So China is going to stop contributing to this world inequality reduction. And the question is whether the China growth is enhancing or actually hindering the rapid development or poverty alleviation of poorer countries. Then in that regard, the record is quite mixed, and it can go both ways depending on the policymakers of different countries. For one thing, that China definitely helped a lot of African countries to have a high economic growth at this particularly for the African countries and Latin American countries that export raw materials, commodities to China. So they benefit a lot from the China boom, and the people, the poor people in these countries benefit a lot. But at the same time, there is a downside. First, this kind of commodity boom is not sustainable, as we can see right now, that many commodity exporters, depending on China demand, has been hit hardly when the China's economy slowed down. And at the same time, the China boom, though lift up the commodity export sectors of many developing countries, it is also creating a lot of obstacles to the industrialization of these countries, because the Chinese manufacturing is so powerful, and then up until recently, the cost is so low that many of these Latin American countries and African countries and other Southeast Asian countries find it quite difficult to industrialize and compete with Chinese manufacturing in the world market. So the China itself, the rapid growth of China itself, is doing a good service to reduction in world inequality and world poverty. But after this effect fades, it is more uncertain whether the China boom is pressing or occurs to further reduction in this poverty and inequality in the rest of the world.
That's right. And in that sense, the chapter explicitly questions what you identify as a widespread perception that China has a role as what you call a great equalizer in the economy. And so there's really interesting attention in this chapter for listeners who are particularly interested in these issues to the China-Africa trade, to China-Latin America, as you mentioned. And also there's some really interesting accounting of India in the case of India. This interest in sort of China, and in particular China-Africa, really continues into the next chapter. So, and I want to ask you a little bit about that. So chapter 5 critiques the idea, so there's another kind of overturning of an assumption, that China's rise is challenging the global dominance of the U.S. So we're going to get to that in a moment, but one of the things, just to pick up on a thread that you were just talking about, one of the things that's interestingly related to this is the point that you make here that China, in contradistinction to an idea that it's kind of undermining or challenging the global dominance of the U.S., it's actually being perceived among some people and among African leaders in particular, you talk about here, as a neo-colonial power. Your African leaders voicing a concern with Chinese colonialism. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that seems interesting and important.
Yeah, that's interesting that we see that in North America, in the Western world, there's kind of a conflicting view about China, whether it is the rise of China is good or bad. And we can actually equally find these kind of conflicting views in the developing world, like in Africa. Definitely many people welcome China investment and China trade, but also there's an increasing number of politicians and social movement in Africa are more critical of China investment, and they see Chinese investment definitely is not like the Mao period revolutionary diplomacy that, of course, at that time that Mao also has their own geopolitical calculations and interests in all these activities. But right now, the Chinese investment is not charity in Africa. So they are just operating like many other capitalist countries and capitalist companies. They want to make profit. They want to exploit natural resources. So on the one hand, China is really the activities in Africa really is not radically different from the old style Western investment in Africa and other developing countries. So it is why the complaint among some African leaders and social movement and the civil society sector that China is another colonial power. But I also point out that it is interesting that even though at the individual country level, China is as bad as or as good as not much different from other colonial, neo-colonial power and capitalist enterprise trying to exploit Africa resources and things like that. But at the aggregate level, that China getting into Africa is creating a new dynamics that can benefit the development of Africa. That because in the in the past, Africa has been, or each African country has been dependent on the market, trading and investment from very limited number of Western countries or their former colonizers, is one country. So it is this kind of dependent on a few market and a few links and make Africa very vulnerable in the negotiation table about anything. But when China comes in, and also it drive other big emerging powers like India and Brazil also, and South Africa to come in, and then it create a kind of a competitive environment. Even though each of these foreign investors and capitalist powers and capitalist company, they are equally capitalist or exploitative or neo-colonial. But when this suitor increase, and then increase the competition among these multiple suitors, and then it create a situation that some African countries, if not all, can have a better bargaining position vis-a-vis their foreign investors and foreign trade partners. And at the aggregate level, it can create some new opportunities for Africa and other developing countries.
So another really important point that this chapter is making, and I kind of alluded to this right at the beginning in mentioning the kind of major or one major goal here in this chapter, is a critique of the idea that China's rise is challenging the hegemony of the U.S.
Yes.
We also talk about sort of the fact of that hegemony and China's place in it. So you talk about the importance of the continuous hegemonic status, as the chapter, in the words of the chapter, of the U.S. dollar in the international monetary system. Now, this interestingly engages China in a way that I think is phrased really, really interestingly. Okay, so you say here, China, through its addiction to U.S. Treasury bonds, and you call, as a historian, among other things, I'm interested in this, you call the U.S. Treasury bonds the new opium, right?
Yes.
So as through its addiction to U.S. Treasury bonds, China has been supporting the hegemony of the U.S. dollar and thus the global dominance of the U.S. Can you speak to that a little bit? What's important about that, again, for the larger kind of argument that this part of the book is making? What do we need to understand that you think is crucial about that for the argument here?
Yes, this is interesting background of it that didn't go into the book, is that when I start to look into this question around 2009 and 2010, many scholars and in the media, they're filled with commentary. Because 2008, two important things happened. One, of course, is the financial crisis, and later China successfully recovered. So it created kind of a conception that actually China became a new sole driver of the world economy and U.S. is tanked. At the same time, in 2008, China surpassed Japan to become the biggest creditor to the U.S. in terms of holding of U.S. Treasury bonds. So it created a wide conception and a lot of conversation that China become the biggest creditor to the U.S. when U.S. economy was in tatters, then China will have a really the upper hand, can use this financial power and this holdings of U.S. Treasury bonds to backmail the U.S. And then to achieve some geopolitical goal. So even this, at that time, the financial market has a fear that at some point China will actually sell many of the U.S. Treasury bond holdings and then drive U.S. economy into a deeper quagmire. And within China, there's also a very kind of triumphalist move, and that's the self-conception that China, at that time is also Olympic years, definitely, that the Beijing Olympic years, that China is the biggest creditor to the U.S., and then now the U.S. should listen to China's lecturing how they run the economy rather than the other way around for many years. So it is all this conception, and this conception traced back to the moment actually of the rise of the U.S. hegemony in displacing the U.K. in 1956, that is the year, because after the Second World War, the U.S. was the biggest holder of U.K. Treasury bonds, and the U.S. has been the biggest creditor to the U.K. during the Second World War and after the Second World War. And in 1956, there was a Suez Canal crisis that the U.K. army invade Egypt, and then U.S. want to broker the peace settlements and ask the U.K. to withdraw the troops, and U.K. actually refused to do it. And then in the end, the U.S. Treasury warned that if that the U.S. can sell the U.K. bonds in the international market to create a currency crisis for U.K., if U.K. didn't yield to this geopolitical demand from the U.S. in the end, that U.K. backed down and withdrew the troops. So it is a moment that marked the replacement of the UK hegemony by the US hegemony, that the US can use these holdings of the government bonds of the UK as a financial weapon to achieve geopolitical mean. So many people allude to this kind of episode to look at the China in 2009, 2010 and saying that China is in the same position to the US as US is in the position to the UK back in 1956. So I'm saying that it is not the case, because the whole world economy, the difference between 1950s and now is in the 1950s, when US could use its financial power to achieve geopolitical and to force UK to do what US want UK to do, because at that time the whole world economy is already in the kind of US dollar standard. Everybody used US dollar, and then the British pound sterling was not that important, so that US can do it. But in 2008, and even China become the biggest creditor to the US, China is still very dependent on U.S. market for its export. And also, the world economy is still in a U.S. dollar standard. And all China export, even the China export to Europe, were settled in U.S. dollar. And then you have to have U.S. dollar to buy oil, to buy copper, all kind of commodities, and China need all this U.S. dollar. So the whole world is still in a U.S. dollar standard. And in this situation, China really didn't have this geopolitical power that they can derive from its holdings of U.S. Treasury bond. And after all, that China's huge holding of U.S. Treasury bond is, as I said, as that you said, that is an addiction, because China rely a lot on this export-oriented growth, and it is where the dynamics of the economy came from. And then in exporting in the global U.S. dollar standard, so China has been raking in all this U.S. dollar with this export. So the only place, only asset that is liquid enough and large enough to absorb this trade surplus that of China denominated in U.S. dollar is the U.S. Treasury bond. So China is basically forced it by its economic model to keep buying U.S. Treasury bonds. So it didn't really have that choice and the option to sell the U.S. Treasury bond as it wish, and to punish or to blackmail the U.S. So in the end, that the data show that I'm right. Between 2008 and 2013, as the data show in the book, that actually China holding of U.S. Treasury bond, despite all these Chinese complaining about the fiscal mess in the U.S. and the loss of confidence in the U.S. dollar, China, while they're talking about this kind of complaint, that China holding of U.S. Treasury bond actually doubled between 2008 and 2013. So it is really an addiction, even though they say that it's bad, we don't want it. But at the same time, they are compelled to keep buying more.
Mm-hmm. So thank you so much. So as we move from chapter 5 to chapter 6, and this is the last substantive chapter of the book before the conclusion, so this actually nicely moves us toward our conclusion. We move from the question of a post-American world, to focus on global crisis. So chapter 6 considers how the particular pattern of capitalist growth in China has generated an increasing economic imbalance, right? Overinvestment, underconsumption in the last two decades.
Yeah.
And you talk here about the ways that China's economic imbalance actually contributed to the global imbalance that precipitated the crash of 2008 that you've talked a little bit about already. Now, because of this, there's a real, really serious need to rebalance Chinese economy.
Yes.
This need is really urgent, and you use that language here. Now, how might that happen? You talk a little bit here about the importance of making household consumption and household income a larger share in the national economy, but as a way of maybe leading us toward our conclusion, can you talk about this? How do we balance China's economy, and why is that so important?
It's interestingly that the Chinese leaders has been talking about rebalancing and making the household consumption the bigger driver in growth in comparison to investment and export since the late 1990s. But up until very recently, that while they're talking about this significant rebalance, the Chinese economy become more and more imbalanced, that rely more on export and investment, and more so in export, because actually, as I point out in the book, all this investment in infrastructures, in apartments, in the excessive steel mill and all that is financed by loans, and which in turn was backed up by the expanding foreign exchange reserve that originated from the export sector. So basically, it is the economic structures that rely on export ultimately, and also with this reliance, it spill over to the investment sector. While investment, while consumption, domestic household consumption definitely has been growing, it's not stagnant, it's actually growing quite rapidly in a world standard. But the problem is not the lack of absolute growth of consumption, but the fact that the consumption is going not as fast as investment and export. So that China constantly has this problem of producing much, much more than the people can consume. So it has to export all these excess capacity and excess goods to the world. And now the world economy, particularly the Western markets that China's export engine has been relying on, is not doing very well. And then the export growth is still growing. It's not like the collapse right after 2008 global financial crisis, but it's not as big and as vibrant as before 2008. So China can no longer rely on this export-oriented growth. And definitely it is very natural and very rational and reasonable to try to shift to a more domestic household consumption driven economy. But it has been difficult because of political reasons, not economic reasons, that China has been more balanced, the economy, in the 1980s, when the policy of the government is tilted toward more to rural sectors. So there's the township village enterprise that produced stuff for domestic market rather than export. There's a rapid improvement in income on peasants and starting to like buy electrical appliances and all these consumer goods. So in the 1980s, that the economy growth is much more balanced. But the imbalance actually started and get bigger and bigger since the 1990s, when the policy making the community in China is tilted toward interest in coastal sectors and state sectors that benefit a lot from the investment and export boom. And the problem now is that there's a lack of a kind of a political representation of the consumers, which are mostly workers and peasants, to move the policy machine back to kind of a mode in which grassroots consumers are more favored. And let me take one example that right after the 2008 financial crisis, there's a lot of more reform-minded, progressive government advisors and economists within China that see that crisis is a good opportunity for China to really rebalance the economy. So don't let the government waste the crisis is a saying at the time. So one proposal to jumpstart the economy and rebalance the economy at that time is to have government providing subsidies and extra spending to give vouchers to peasant consumers to buy electrical appliances and computer and all that. So it is really, actually it is a very standard kind of stimulus policy that India and Brazil and many other developing countries do. But in the end, that the industrial lobby in China successfully lobbied the government to twist the kind of a stimulus policy away from giving direct cash subsidies to peasants to buy electrical appliances, to shift it away from that and then shift it to the final policy that the government gives subsidies to the manufacturers of white goods to let them use this extra subsidy to convert into discount to consumers. So in the end, the consumers still get some benefits. They get discounts. But what happened as it turned out is that many of these manufacturers pocket the government subsidies, so they don't translate all of these subsidies into consumer discount, and then they actually take nearly half of it into their own, and then they use it for investment and all other kind of speculative activities. So it is how the policy process hinder this kind of a consumption shift. If the government directly subsidize consumer to buy things, that the consumption can be stimulated in a much larger scale. But in the end, it is the industrial lobby that tilt the policy toward the advantage. In the end, they stimulate consumption, but not as much as it could have been. And then, and many of the subsidies didn't go to the consumer, but go to the enterprises, and the enterprise used it for investment and speculative activity that in the end make the economy more imbalanced. So it is this kind of political structures that the enterprises and urban governments and all these vested interests have good access to the government to tilt the policy toward their favor, and also to ask the government to often open the tape of cheap loan for them to borrow and then build stuff and then to further increase their investment spree. And then there's no institutionalized advocate for the consumers, which is mostly the grassroots workers and peasants. So it is this political structures that is hindering China's rebalancing.
Great. Thank you so much, Hofeng. And I'll just say as well, just to put a point on it, that as we come to the end of this chapter, the chapter is also challenging an important perception. And just as we've been talking about in the case of previous chapters, and this is the perception that China is, in the words of the book, a savior to the global economy in crisis. Mm-hmm. Instead, it argues that China is a major source of global economic imbalances and crises, and finally, that the China boom is set to fade. Okay, Hofeng, so we're at our conclusion, and there are so many other things that we could talk about, right? The book is full of fancy theory, or at least engagements, is what you call fancy theory. It's full of data. It's full of really, really interesting and important engagements. Then we just scratched the surface. But given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners or leave listeners with, especially perhaps listeners who haven't yet become readers?
Yeah, actually, that many people told me that they're impressed by the cover of the book. Actually, that whenever I talk about a book, I have to put this disclaimer that I'm not responsible for the cover, though I like it. Remembering that in the spring of 2015, when the publisher gave me the cover, so I was taken aback and actually a little bit panicking because putting a Chinese national flag on a pop balloon is going to offend some people's feeling, and who kind of see the Chinese national flag as a sacred cow. And also, if you remember, in the spring of 2015, the Chinese stock market is going sky high. It is the height of the bubble, and many people even saying that the Chinese economic slowdown is going to fade away, and then China is going to go into another time of prosperity because of this genius government-fueled stock market boom. It's going to help enterprise repay the debt and so on and so forth. So I really a little bit worried that if this provocative cover comes out, and then I might look bad when the Chinese economy still look apparent, because I know that the fundamental of the economy is not doing very well, but at least it appears that I'm wrong, that the Chinese economy is actually going into the next stage of prosperity. But in the end, that fortunately or unfortunately, that the financial turmoil just starting in the fall of 2015 and actually it stabilized a little bit now, but it is still continuing. It's make the book and that cover quite timely. I have to clarify that actually I see that that balloon is not a pop balloon. It is a deflated balloon that it can be reflated again. And you see that the Chinese government is what exactly the Chinese government trying to do. They reflate a bubble to kind of cover up the economic slowdown. So, but I'm glad that the book came out in a timely way. It seemed that the Chinese economic trouble is not going to go away anytime soon. But it is only in the short run that I am not particularly optimistic about the Chinese economy. But in the long run, I think sooner or later, China will find its way to rebalance its economy and to grow modestly again. And China is not going to become the center of the world. It is going on the way, even if it fixes its economy and rebalances economy, it's just going to become another ordinary major capitalist economic power. It's not going to change the world system of capitalism fundamentally, and it will be like Japan and Germany, and side by side with all other new emerging power. So we are not going to heading towards a brave new world. It is going to be an old world, an old order with a new capitalist power in the end.
So sorry, listeners, if you were expecting a brave new world, we're here to tell you it's not
going to
happen.
Or not going to happen because of China. Maybe it is still going to happen, but not because of China, because of something
maybe
else.
Maybe it'll happen because of the podcast revolution or something.
Be more possible.
So, Hofung, now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's next for you? What are you currently working on and inspired by?
Yeah, and I have two projects going on. One is actually a direct outgrowth of the book, because I talk about the fact that trying to purchase a U.S. Treasury bond is an addiction, rather than a leverage over the U.S. And actually, the Chinese leader definitely know it. They just don't admit it. The sign that they know it is that they know that they're addicted to the U.S. Treasury bond, so far as the world is still in the U.S. Dollar standard. And then the only way to get out from this addiction is to improve and increase the international use of the RMB, its own currency. So China can settle its trade with RMB, and then ideally to use RMB to buy commodities and oil and other world resources. So it is why the Chinese leadership is very active in promoting the internationalization of the RMB. So my new project right now is to look at this political and sociological dynamics and the dilemmas and the challenges of this internationalization project that has something to do with CCP power, which is one of the foundation of CCP power now is its control of credit. So this internationalization is going to require the CCP to let go some of this power. So what would this political impact would be? And also the very important part of this internationalization of RMB process is the using Hong Kong as offshore RMB market, then to defend and maintain Hong Kong autonomous status. But at the same time, it has political social backlash. So how the Chinese government is deal with this kind of dilemma of the economic necessity to keep Hong Kong at the arm length to develop it as a RMB offshore center, and to how to contain the political and opposition that growing out from this autonomy is the thing that I have been looking at. Another project is looking at less developed, so it is more or less about the political economy of U.S.-China policy. To look back to the 1990s, the Clinton administration about different lobby groups and industrial financial sectors, how they interact with different social sectors in the U.S. To create a kind of policy regime that favor opening up China trade, that lead up to the China accession to the WTO and create a backlash that in the U.S. now facing against free trade and against China.
Great. Well, thank you for taking time away from that to talk with me about this book, Hofung, and best of luck with that work. And thank you for this conversation. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for interviewing me and reading the book.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.